Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
I think anyone who has suffered the loss of a child knows that there's just a lot of time spent with family and friends and clergy people.
We lost our daughter. That's the worst possible thing that could have happened to us. Anything that has happened in the aftermath pales by comparison.
We feel like there are at least two people on the face of this earth that know who did this. And that is the killer and someone that person may have confided in.
Welcome to episode 3 of The Killing of JonBenet Ramsey, The Final Suspects. I'm your host, Danielle Robay. Last time we heard how 23 years after the broken and abused body of 6-year-old JonBenet Ramsey was discovered by her father in the basement of their Boulder, Colorado home, the identity of her murder still baffles law enforcement officers.
Bottom line, there's still a killer out there.
But also how? Armed with a list of remaining suspects from lead detective Lou Smith, a new team of investigators, journalists, and private citizens are doing what the Boulder Police Department has yet to be able to do, put aside any agenda, other than finding answers for the Ramseys. It is this spreadsheet and a short list of 10 suspects that is now forming the basis of our new investigation. Dylan Howard, Doug Longini, Jameson, and their team, along with John and John Andrew Ramsey, are determined to pick up what Detective Lou Smith could not finish.
It used to be when I'd wake up in the morning, I had to get up quick because I'd lay in bed and start thinking. That was tough to start your day that way. But I get reminded. You know, I have pictures of JonBenet and Beth, my other daughter, on my desk. And okay, sometimes I look at that and it makes me both happy and sad.
Well, for so long, I think my father's kind of bore the brunt of working with the media and putting himself out there. And he's gone to tremendous lengths to really to protect us kids so that we can have a semblance of a normal life. At the same time, I've got a vested interest in this. I've got young children myself. My life has been affected by this murder. And, you know, I want the truth. And that's why I'm doing this. I don't have any aspirations to beyond just getting to the truth. And this is a means to an end, as I see it.
You know, we were naive. I mean, Patsy came from a small town in West Virginia. I was born and raised in Lincoln, Nebraska. We thought the world was a nice place.
John Andrew, along with sisters Elizabeth and Melinda, lived with their mother in Atlanta. Their parents had divorced in 1978, and John married Patsy in 1980. Burke Ramsey was born in 1987, and JonBenet 3 years later. Even after John and Patsy's move to Boulder, all the children remained close. This is John Andrew.
My dad's company had merged with two others, and the headquarters was in Boulder. And then once Access Graphics was sold to Lockheed Martin, my dad was, I think, promoted to CEO, president, and of course at that point made the move to full-time in Boulder. But coming from Atlanta, Boulder was kind of a novelty, right? I mean, I tell a story of going out there as a seventh grader with me and a buddy, and we had our bikes and we could ride our bikes everywhere. I mean, this was unthinkable in, you know, the sprawl of Atlanta. You could walk to places. It was kind of this quaint small town, or so we thought.
We didn't pay attention to keeping our doors locked. We thought we lived in a nice, safe community. You know, one of the things the police asked me early on, do you know anybody that could have done this? And I said, I don't know anybody this evil. This is an evil, horrible thing that a human being did to a child. I don't know anybody. I've never met anybody that's that evil.
John Andrew remembers JonBenet, some 14 years his junior, as a boisterous, fun-loving kid.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say we were best buddies or anything, but as I remember, being really a tomboy. I mean, she had this older brother, Burke, who had a bunch of, you know, neighborhood buddies that played baseball and, you know, whatever sports of the day, and she just kind of hung out with them. And I really saw her as a tomboy. But yeah, she was a sweet, fun kid. I think some of this has been trumped up and really portrayed as this overwhelming personality, but I guess I don't remember that, and I think of her as just a genuine, sweet kid.
One of the things that I regret, big time, obviously, is that we didn't take our home security more seriously. We thought we lived in a very peaceful Ossie and Harriet type of community. Our house had an alarm system in the house when we bought it, but it was one that put out this excruciating noise, and the theory behind that type of system was it drives you nuts. And if somebody's an intruder, he just wants to get out of the house because his eardrums are breaking. And so we never used it. JonBenet set it off once, just punching buttons, and it was horrible. And she said, it makes my ears loud. Said, yeah, that's the idea. So we never used it because it was a horrible system.
But on the morning after Christmas, 1996, everything changed.
Our plan that morning, the 26th, was to get up early, fly to Minneapolis, meet John and my daughter Melinda, and then go on up to northern Michigan for like a second Christmas with the older kids. And then they were going to go back home, and we were going to take JonBenet and Burke on a Disney cruise.
So it was the day after Christmas, and I had spent Christmas with my sister Melinda and mother in Atlanta. And day after Christmas, we were flying to meet my dad and Patsy and family. Ultimately, we're going to go to Charlevoix, Michigan, where at the time we had a home. But the plan was to meet in Minneapolis. So we were flying to Minneapolis, got off the airplane, and I can't remember if someone handed me a note, you know, flight attendant or somebody. I think they pulled me aside and said, you need to call home, essentially. Got a payphone and called my dad, and he told me that JonBenet had been kidnapped. And I think we just made the split-second decision to fly to Denver at that point.
After Patsy discovered the ransom note claiming JonBenet had been kidnapped, she called 911. The police responded, and so began the initial agonizing wait for the family.
Well, I described the feeling to people, it's like when you're in a shopping center and you've got your small child with you and you're looking through clothing and you look around and they're gone. And you have this hit in the gut, like, oh my God, where did she go? Where did he go? And you start frantically looking. And then you find him over in the next aisle somewhere, you know, minutes later. Well, I had that panic, hit in the gut feeling all morning. What have I got to do to get her back? It's cold out there. It's dark. And I got to do whatever I'm capable of doing. That's what we called the police immediately, obviously, to get her back. That was my whole focus. But I was helpless. I didn't know what to do. You know, I was thinking we need to block the roads. We need to get police at the airport. The cops are here. They know what they're doing. I don't know. I don't know what should be done. But in retrospect, they didn't have a clue what they were doing. And I should have, I don't know how it would have escalated it, but I should have called a friend in the governor's office. I should have done something to say, look, we got a major problem. I need help. Call out the National Guard. I don't know. But I thought, the kidnappers said, I'll call you tomorrow at 10 o'clock. and I didn't know if tomorrow was tomorrow or the day we were in. So 10 o'clock came and went, and the police thought it was suspicious that I didn't fall to pieces when they didn't call at 10. But I didn't know if he meant tomorrow at 10 o'clock. I thought, my God, if I got to wait 24 hours. So I didn't know, but the police observed that I didn't let 10 o'clock come and go, and I didn't crash and burn as suspicious. I was going through the mail, and they thought that was bizarre. I was looking for another communication from the kidnapper, anything. I was looking out the window, looking, is there anybody watching the house? I was trying to do whatever I could to get my daughter back. And I think the police had watched too much grade C crime movies. I should have been over tearing my hair out and ripping my clothes off and crying. I was a father. I wanted to get her back. What can I do? You know, this isn't over. When I lost my daughter, Beth, she was killed in a car accident. I got a call from my brother and said, Beth is dead. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't get the best doctors for her. I couldn't fly to her. It was over. This wasn't over in my mind that morning. I could do something to get my daughter back, but I wasn't sure what to do.
I love solving puzzles. That's what true crime is to me, after all, just one big puzzle. When I want to take a break from the dark stuff, though, I like to lighten up my puzzle time with Best Fiends. Best Fiends is a puzzle game where every level feels like uncovering a new layer in a story, one you get to take part in. I love that the game is challenging while not being frustrating. The best part for me is when I have to choose the fiends I want on my team for each level. I have to make sure I'm playing the best fiends possible based on their skill sets, and since every level is different, it requires me to choose wisely for every challenge. The more I play, the more fun it gets. Plus, you don't need the internet to play, so anytime I want a little entertainment, Best Fiends is my go-to. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips, and you can even play online. With over 100 million downloads and tons of 5-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
Finally, at 1 p.m., one of the police officers, Detective Linda Arndt, asked John to have another look around the house to check if anything seemed amiss.
And then you find your daughter, which is, I can't even imagine. I can't.
Well, it was at first a relief. It's like, oh my God, I found her. It was just a flood of thankfulness. And then I pretty quickly realized that she wasn't alive. And I just screamed and carried her upstairs. I don't know.
As John Andrew tells Doug Longini, he and Sister Melinda arrived in Boulder to a scene of horror.
So I can't exactly remember, but somehow we got on an airplane to Denver and flew there and arrived, took a taxi cab from the airport and arrived right as just after they had found the body. They were walking out of the house. So it was quite a scene.
It had to be a very difficult flight for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember being scared, too. I didn't know who had done this against our family. And as I remember it, we were getting out of the cab, and Dad and Patsy were coming out of the house. Presumably, they had just found Chamonix's body. And we were ushered into a car, essentially, or van. My dad said to the effect that Chamonix is in heaven or has been killed. I mean, Patsy was just devastated. I mean, on the floor, just devastated. The police were there, of course. And the thing I can remember is Burke being brought in, and he was just a 9-year-old, you know, smiling little boy, and his best friend, his sister, his little sister was murdered, and that was just devastating to me to see that. Because, you know, he had just had this look of innocence on him walking in there. Kind of a big, awkward smile. Kind of like, oh, I know this is not good. All these people around me are crying. My mother's on the floor. But, you know, he's a 9-year-old. Just awful.
The nightmare, however, was just beginning. And, as it turned out, the investigation into who killed JonBenet was to be defined from the start by a series of catastrophic blunders by the Boulder Police Department.
I met a forensics expert years later, and he said it was bizarre what they didn't do. He said the first thing we do when a child is missing is we go through the house thoroughly. Were they hiding under a blanket? Were they hiding in a closet? Were they playing some kind of game? We look everywhere in the house first. They didn't do that. But that's the first thing you do if a child's missing. This police work 101 didn't happen. You know, the way our country is structured, for the most part, we have 18,000 police jurisdictions. If a crime occurs in that jurisdiction, that crime is the responsibility of the local police. If they don't ask for help, help cannot be given. And that certainly was the case in Boulder. Are they expert in everything? No. Are they wise enough to know they're not? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. In our case, the answer was no. They thought they could handle it. They tend to be very territorial, very protective of their cases, and they want to not have help. And that's unfortunate. Ego is getting in the way.
This is an expert on the JonBenet Ramsey case, Jameson.
They turned down help immediately from the Denver police, who said, you've had, what, one homicide in how many years? We have, unfortunately for Denver, a much larger number. And Denver said, we have got the people that know how to do the crime scenes. Let us help you. And Boulder apparently said,
no, it's our case. We can handle it.
You know, don't think we're like Mayberry and unable to do anything. We'll take care of our own.
Yep.
And so Denver had to step back and let Boulder do their thing, which they didn't do very well in hindsight.
Yep. Well, that's the one thing I will hold Boulder responsible for. I don't criticize them because they had no experience. I appreciate that they were working on it, but they should have realized they didn't have the expertise or the experience to deal with it, and they should have welcomed the help of Denver, for example, or the sheriff's department or whomever. And that's what I will fault them for.
That next day, we went down to the police station. And, you know, in my mind, I'm a dumb 19-year-old kid, and I don't really connect the dots that it's an interrogation, but that's what it was, at least in the police mind, right? So they separate me from my family for hours on end, bring me into some, you know, windowless, you know, interrogation room. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm sure there's a video of this somewhere out there in the world, thinking that, okay, well, here comes the best and brightest. Here comes the FBI, you know, CBI. This is, okay, good. We're going to get to an answer here. And in walk Ron Gossage and Steve Thomas from the Boulder Police. And they hand me their business cards, and I look at it, and one says auto theft, and the other says narcotics. And literally, I just buried my head in my hands because I knew at that point we were screwed. These guys had no business investigating a homicide. So the hope of finding the suspect at that moment was, you know, in jeopardy at that day one.
One does auto theft, one does narcotics.
Yeah.
Same thing happened to you?
Patsy was pretty well gone. I mean, she was just devastated, but I talked to them, as you know, answered any questions they had, tried to, and they said, well, we need you to come down to the station. And by then the media was outside. I said, we're not going to go down, you know, why don't you guys come here? We'll talk to you as much as you want, but you please come here. And this is a safe haven for us. Somebody out there killed our child. We don't know who they were. We don't want to go out in front of 20 TV cameras. Just please come here and we'll talk to you for sure.
The initial police operation had been defined by incompetence. What followed appeared to be a campaign directed squarely against the Ramseys themselves.
They go, well, no, we need you to come down to the station. We got papers down there. Well, at that moment, Mike Bynum, who was a good friend, was there delivering some food for the people that were there, including us. And he was a former assistant district attorney, knew the Boulder police, knew what they were good at, what they weren't good at. And he said, time out. I'm an attorney. Came over to me and said, John, would you allow me to do some things here that I think are necessary? I said, yeah, of course. And Mike apparently then told police, Lindarn, that no, they're not going to come to the station. You call me later. They're trying to get us. And I had gotten a call that same day from a fellow that worked for me. And he said, John, I got this message from somebody inside the system. I won't tell you who it was. But they said, tell John to get the best defense attorney he can get his hands on because they think he killed his daughter and they're out to get him. They being the police. And I'm thinking, holy mackerel. Unbelievable. And so I was sort of primed for Mike to say, you need an attorney because I'd gotten this call, this warning. So, well, okay, whatever. And the next day he introduced us to two attorneys. I said, well, what do we need two attorneys for? He said, well, one attorney can't represent both of you in Colorado. And wanted to sit down with the police, do whatever we could to help move this forward. And so we went back to Atlanta, buried JonBenet in our family cemetery plot. And said, okay, let's go back to Boulder. Let's get on with finding the killer. And they said, not so fast. And they pretty much said, police are out to get you.
They take DNA. Did they tell you right away the results of that?
No, they didn't. We saw the results several years later, which said, we've tested the family. They're excluded. There's no match. But they kind of overlooked that little problem. But we gave them everything they ever asked for, period. There's nothing they asked for we didn't give them. We gave them our bank records. We gave them our credit card records, our phone records. We gave them DNA. We gave them hair samples. We gave them pubic hair samples. We gave them, it seemed like volumes of handwriting samples. They had us rewrite that horrible note with our right hand and then with our left hand. I probably wrote that note, which is very painful, 6-7 times. So they could then look at my handwriting and make a judgment as to whether I wrote the note or not. So we did everything they asked for.
Well, yeah, I mean, so, you know, day one, we go down to the police station because why wouldn't you? And yeah, I gave handwriting samples and blood samples and hair samples and pubic hair samples, which is a, you know, it's a pretty traumatic experience. And I'm sure we gave fingerprints and all sorts of stuff. But thing you would, anybody would do in that situation. That's what we did. They did not fess up that there was foreign male DNA in multiple locations on JonBenet's body for a long time. But yeah, of course, eventually they compare my sample, and of course it doesn't match.
And none of your families matched.
None of the families matched, yeah.
They were not dealing with good cops. They were dealing with cops that want to convict us of murder.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
The strain on the grieving family was almost unbearable.
So what happens to your brain during this period, John? Your daughter's, just lost a daughter, and you're dealing with, I mean, your family's a wreck, understandably.
Yeah.
You're
in shock. I mean, you don't know it necessarily, but you're in shock, and you're absolutely not capable of making good decisions. And I write that in my book. I said, if you take one thing out of this book, take this. Do not make big decisions after a tragedy. And I'm not talking about the next month. I'm talking about a couple years. Give your friend your checkbook. Don't sell your house. Don't move to, just park it. Everything. Park it. Your job. Park it. Park your finances, because you're not capable of making good decisions. You're really not. You're in horrible, deep shock. And I was. But you don't necessarily recognize it.
Having lost their daughter and sister in the most brutal way possible, the Ramseys soon realized that things would only get worse.
When did you start thinking, wait a minute, there's something wrong here?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I knew where I was. I was thousands of miles away in Atlanta, Georgia, with my family and friends. But I think probably the moment I got my dad hired a lawyer for me and my sister Melinda, because the police had made a concerted effort to basically dangle me out into the press as a potential suspect. And they did it on purpose, we now know. Their intent there was, they knew I didn't have anything to do with it, but their intent was to put public pressure on my dad, Patsy, to see if they would break. That's dishonest and just awful. I mean, these guys were young, inexperienced, and in a tornado of public scrutiny. And I can understand that. That's hard. And, police by nature they're a fraternity, right? It's a brotherhood. And as I see it, what these guys did is they circled the wagons and they protected their own and they fought viciously to protect their own and their reputation. And I don't agree with that. I would like to think if I was in their shoes, I would have realized that I was outgunned and didn't have the experience to solve this and to reach out for help.
In 1997, with their case floundering, Boulder PD brought in legendary retired detective Lou Smith, who, with hundreds of successful homicide investigations under his belt, was seen as the man to finally crack the case. A year later, he was forced to resign again after presenting to the department his absolute conviction that an intruder was responsible for JonBenet's murder. Undeterred, he continued to work the case under his own steam until his death 9 years ago.
Did you ever get to meet Lou Smith?
I did a couple times. The first time I met Lou Smith, they brought me in, or he asked to talk to me. I didn't know about what. He said, what do you know about stun guns? I said, well, I don't know anything about stun guns, And to be frank, at the time, I was pretty distrustful and bitter towards the police. And I kind of lumped Lou into that collective. But yeah, over time, learning of his reputation and just seeing his work, that a man of integrity would just to follow the truth. I mean, that's hard to do in that environment where there's a lot of public pressure. Everything was being leaked to the media the world over. To kind of stand on your principles is hard to do.
He used to tell me, I'm going to get this guy. I'm going to get him. And he'd gotten a lot of criminals in his career. That's what his reputation was founded on. Solved over 100 cold cases. It's amazing.
And Detective Smith did not work alone.
Who was Ollie Gray?
Ollie Gray was a retired homicide detective from California, also been a judge for a number of years, had quite a career in law enforcement, was retired in Colorado Springs and got interested in this case early on and did quite a bit of work on it. He and Lou worked pretty closely together. They both lived in Colorado Springs. Ollie knew a lot about the case. And I say both he and Lou were long-time homicide detectives and had lots of experience and kind of real-life Columbos, basically.
How did you first get involved with Jameson?
We became aware of Jameson. She was reported to have a very detailed timeline of information online about our case, and it was very accurate, very non-biased one way or the other. Wasn't trying to convince people we were guilty or innocent. It was just the facts. She had a good reputation for her website of being very accurate in this data. Well, that started barely early on, and she has maintained it over the years. She was very careful about making sure it was accurate and correct. She put it on her site.
At that point, I was pretty well known as being a supporter of the intruder theory. I had made some enemies. The Ramseys were aware of my existence. I became worried that somebody might pretend to be me to gain their trust and hurt them. And I felt I had to stop that, so I met with them. And when I came out here I came out here several times then. And each time I would meet with Lou Smith, just a wonderful guy. And he introduced me to Ollie Gray, and he introduced me to several other people that were working on the case.
After Lou Smith's death, he left all his case files to his daughter, Cindy Mara, as well as his master spreadsheet detailing every suspect for the murder of JonBenet.
He developed this database of people of interest in our case that come in as tips, and each name had a columnist, what had been done, if anything, on this tip. Was it followed up on? Was DNA taken? Fingerprints taken? You know, that kind of thing. Very extensive database, very thorough. And when he died, he left that as a legacy. And Cindy Mara, his daughter, has taken up that database and moved forward on doing what Lou would have done had he lived.
So yeah, that's it's really a gift he left, because, you know, as a family here, we have nothing else. You know, the police haven't shared any information with us. So the work that Lou did is what we've got.
It is this spreadsheet and a final short list of 10 suspects that is now forming the basis of our new investigation. Doug Longini, Jameson, and their team, along with John and John Andrew Ramsey, are determined to finally finish what Detective Smith started.
And they formed this team, and they've kept very low profile, but they are basically taking Lou's extensive database of information on this case and methodically going through each name, each lead, and either eliminating it or pursuing it. And they're eliminating it based on getting DNA, because we have foreign male DNA, always have had in this case, and Lou felt it was going to be solved by finding a DNA match. So they're going through and getting DNA from each of these people and either taking them off the list because the DNA didn't match, or if there's some connection, then pursuing it further. And they're going from the top down. But they do believe that the name of the killer is in that list. They're very convinced of that.
Is there still evidence that should be tested for DNA?
I mean, one, we have the killer's DNA. Let's start there. So that's hugely important and will ultimately solve this crime. And two, yes, there are additional items that should be tested, you know, given today's new technology, for additional samples. And then three, yeah, I mean, the, you know, advent of using genealogy to identify a killer is hugely promising. And that technology will only get better, right? I mean, from where we were in 1996 to where we are today, it's been just leaps and bounds, an improvement in the DNA technology. So in my mind, if it's not today, it's tomorrow. We're going to crack this. I'm absolutely confident in that.
Well, Lou Smith told me that early on, that there was foreign DNA under her fingernails. He said she got a piece of it. I think Lou believed this was going to be solved by DNA, period.
Part of the challenge with our case is just the volume of information. And that over time that's gone by, there's no one in the police department that really understands this case anymore.
They're not new people. The same people that were there and didn't solve this in 22 years are the same people in charge now.
Well, I think in terms of moving it forward, if we can get the Boulder police to test the evidence that hadn't been tested for DNA, we understand that there were five pieces sent in for testing to the DNA lab. Only one or two were tested. The other three, I assume, were returned back to the police evidence files. We can take those three pieces, have them tested, see what DNA is on there, the rope, the tape, you know, these things that the killer obviously had to touch.
I mean, this is, in my mind, a simple process of just working through the list, collecting DNA, and you're either in or out. This isn't rocket science at this point. I believe we have the name of the killer on Lou's list, and we need to now put in the effort to track down these individuals, collect their DNA, and rule them in or out.
Next time on the killing of JonBenet Ramsey, the final suspects.
There was a person who had committed suicide, and they were looking at that person because he had a stun gun and he had high-tech shoes.
I can tell you I've been to a lot of suicide deaths, and I've never seen anybody shoot themselves down in their lower left torso.
The Killing of JonBenet, The Final Suspects, is hosted by me, Danielle Robé. Executive produced by Dylan Howard and Matt Sprouse, and is a production of Broad and Water Studios and Endeavor Audio. Executive producers also include Tom Freestone, Doug Longini, Susan Bennett, James Robertson, and Andy Tillett. The series is written by Dominic Utten, reporting by Doug Montero. The series is mixed and engineered by Sean Kravitz and Sam Ada. There is so much more to this story, and you don't want to miss anything, I can assure you. Subscribe to The Killing of JonBenet, The Final Suspects, wherever you get podcasts. If you have any information that could help our investigators and the Ramseys identify JonBenet's killer, please help us at tips@justiceforjonbenet.com.